So they start officially at 2:10, I guess that's what they have on their watch there. Almost. What I want to discuss is something which is very close to yesterday's talk of Harald. So the what appears here as a conjecture, what I learned from Alex's talk, this is a problem of Lubotsky and Weiss. This is basically, yeah. Which Weiss is this? This is Benchy Weiss or Benchy Weiss? Okay. What I will do is make some kind of overview of that and give you some further results and show how they connect to what we heard yesterday. So the general situation is the following. We have a set S in SLDZ. So it starts like yesterday's talk, but it's basically same ingredients in a different different problem. So we assume that they generate a Zariski dense group, and what the claim is about is that if you look at the reductions mod Q, you're going to have for the Cayley graphs, so Cayley graph on SLDZ Z mod QZ coming from that specific set S, you're going to have an expander family as long as you keep Q relative prime with some Q0. So quite important in things I will discuss is that you start from a given set S in SLDZ, and there are many things I'm going to do that would not work if you would just take any set of generators in SLDZ mod QZ for some reasons which will be obvious later on. So well, one of the motivations was prime sieving, if you care about that, but I believe that the problem was independently, at least that since I saw that the problem appeared first in this context, but then I learned from Alex that it was already posed by people in group theory, Lubotsky, Weiss, and so on. So there's one important point. Before we're talking about expanders, we need that the graph be connected. So here there is a result of Matthews Weisselstein Weiss failure, which tells you that if G is Zariski dense, so it is a subgroup of SLDZ which is Zariski dense. This is not well phrased here, I'm sorry. It's a subgroup of SLDZ which is Zariski dense in SLDR. The statement is that you will have onto for the reduction mod Q as long as Q is relative prime with some Q0. So this is one place I'm going to use the property that G is that the group is Zariski dense. There will be another place, namely when I will rely on the total irreducibility of certain representations that will come up. Now, what happens for D equals 2? Well, for D equals 2, we have already quite satisfactory understanding there. In fact, we even have also stronger statements. So D equals 2, there is the work with Alex Gambert and also Peter Cernak, and based essentially on Helfgott's product theorem. I will come back on that. So for Q prime, in fact, we know a little bit more. What I said is that you're starting from a set, from a certain set in SLDZ. What you could do is look for stronger statements where you really start from a set in SLDP, or more generally SLDQ, making an assumption about generating the full group. Now, we don't quite know to do that in this generality yet, but what we know is that you will have a uniform control on the expander constant, provided you have an information about the GERD. So what I'm considering here is a set, subset of SL2P with an assumption that there is a GERD which is proportional to the logarithm of P. So you cannot have more than basically something of the order of the logarithm of P. Well, let's assume that it's proportional to the logarithm of P with a constant tau that can be arbitrarily small, but given. Then what you can conclude is an expander estimate with a constant which only depends on tau. Now, of course, the question is, if I give you a set of generators of SL2P, do you know something about the GERD? Well, you don't really know, need to know the GERD, but something which is kind of similar to this GERD information, and at that stage we do not have that kind of result. So it may very well be that you will have a uniform control on the expander constant independent of the generator. This would be the full Lubotsky problem, and at that stage this is not clear. But we certainly have the result when you start from a given system in SLZ, because if it's a given system, say, if it contains a free group, you're certainly going to have a GERD if you do the reduction mod P, which is at least proportional to the logarithm of P. Of course, this proportionality constant is going to depend on the size of the matrix elements of the given set S. I mean, this goes by itself. Now, that was generalized for square threes and for Q square three, and this was mostly motivated by primes. So what we have there is a similar statement. So again, but let's now start from elements S coming from SL2Z. If Q is a square free modulus, then we have a control of the expansion coefficient independently of Q, again provided Q is relative prime with some given with certain integer Q0 that depends on the set S. Now, there is one thing which is rather questionable, is that to do this analysis somehow we have to go back to the basically the proof of the product theorem. Basically you have to go back first to some product results, product theorem, etc. So you kind of have to redo what Harald did in SL2P in the context of SL2Q. And there may be, this I don't exclude, there may be a direct way to use the expansion results in SLT motor prime to get the expansion result in SL2Z mod QZ. So there could be a certain, I mean, it's possible that the way the proof goes is perhaps not the best possible way, and that somehow you're going back to the scalar theorems and the sum product phenomena in Z mod QZ, but this is not clear. In any case, you have the result, and this result is applied in a number of rather amazing problems in prime sieving. Now, I'm citing you one here, which is saying that if G contains a free group in SL2Z, so we are talking here about a group in SL2Z, so a non-elementary subgroup of SL2Z, well, you can find an integer R. I think we call this the saturation number or something, so that if you're taking all the elements in that group which contain, so you're looking at matrix ABCD, with ABCD containing most R prime factors, it is Zariski dense. Zariski dense in SL2R, which is more than saying that there are infinitely many. Of course, the interest of that result is also that it appears in a certain context which is not obviously SL2 related, because basically one can start looking at orbits, one can start looking at points in say quadratic varieties in a certain number of variables, especially we're looking at 3 or 4 variables, and then do some prime sieving on that, and somehow the SL2 theory comes automatically because it gives you the reductions mod p of certain isometry groups acting on the hyperbolic space. And but I won't go into that. I mean, this is definitely something that seems to be different when you're going in higher dimension hyperbolic space, that, well, these groups of isometries are not going to be SLNs anymore, but some other groups. But in any case, definitely for 3 and 4 variables, this SL2P, they came up naturally there. Now, what I will talk about is something which is a rather different kind of modulus. So now we're going to the other edge. This was for Qs which are square free. Let's look at the case where Q is P to the N. And I think I will convince you in a few minutes why this is interesting. So it turns out that, in fact, for that kind of modulus, there is a rather different strategy. Well, the basic strategy is always the same, but there is a rather different strategy possible on the level of the amplification, what you may call the product theorem part. This is a joint. Well, there are two parts. I mean, there is a part for d equals 2 and a part d larger than 2. A joint thing with Alex Gambert. What is the statement? Well, you get the theorem below. So again, the same thing. We have this conjecture. We are starting from a set S in SLDZ, generating as a risky dense group in SLDR. You take a Q which is of the form P at the power N. Now P is going to be sufficiently large to avoid the Q zero from the strong approximation property business. We are looking then at the graphs SLD Z mod QZ, Cayley graphs associated to the reduction mod Q of S. And well, what happens is that if D is equal to 2, we have a uniform control of the expansion, uniform in P and in N, and for D larger than 2, at least we have control which is for a given P, which is, so if I vary, if I give you P and I vary N, then you're going to have an expander family. Of course, if you want to have uniformity in P, the least you should have also is a statement for N equals 1. So if you go to SL3, at least you will have you need to have the expander statement in SL3P. No, you have this expander statement, no, but a posteriori. But in any case, when we were doing that, we did not have. Essentially, what happens is that as soon as you get over 1, you have different techniques you can use. So if you're looking at irreducible representations, if they're induced by SLDP, then you have to do something else. But if they come from higher up, then you can use the methods which I'm discussing here. So let me also point out that basically the SL2PN result is, if you want, the periodic counterpart of what happens in SU2. So it's also quite likely that the techniques which are used here can be used to do the SU2 case, and probably, I would believe, eventually also SUD. So for SU2, you have a result which has quite a bit of applications, actually, and which tells you that if you consider a system of elements in SU2 which are algebraic, so instead of starting with general elements, I will assume that they are algebraic, and this is, if you want, the counterpart of taking elements in SLDZ, right? So instead of taking elements in SLDZ, I'll take them in SU2 now, but with algebraic interests. And assume that they generate a free group. I don't know if I wrote that there. If you then consider the corresponding Hack operator, you're going to have a spectral gap. And the spectral gap, well, it's going to depend on the given G1, GK, but the way it depends on G1, GK, it's through a non-commutative Diophantine property. I will not define what it is. In fact, if you go to the paper of Gamber, Jacobson, and Sarnak, you will see that described in detail also why algebraic elements do have this non-commutative Diophantine property. But the truth is that one needs, in fact, much less than this non-commutative Diophantine property. This condition is the counterpart, if you want, of the large Gerd assumption. But you can do with less. Still, there are a number of problems left, and for instance, what we don't know is whether generic, if you take k random elements in SU2, whether this Heck operator would have a spectral gap. This is still unclear. There are a number of related problems, conjectures there, and maybe I will have some time later to talk again about it, but probably not. Now, the interest of that, well, historically, that played a role, of course, in the Banach-Ruzievich problem, but it has also an interest when you're trying in quantum computation to express general gates, which are elements of SUD or SU2, by what they call fault-tolerant gates. By the way, all these gates, they are algebraic, so the context of algebraic elements for the application is not really a restriction. Then there are other applications in the theory of chaotic crystals, for instance, quasi-crystals, which is describing the distribution of the orientations in the Conway-Rad, what they call the Conway-Rad and quaquaversal tiling. I believe I spoke about that in Montreal 2 years ago. So and somehow these are rather natural applications where these groups come in. And like I said, the context is usually always algebraic so that you can use that statement. Now, okay, what I will more focus on is the following result, which is the SL2D context. So what we have is a given set S, sorry. So I have, everything will depend on the given set S in SLD, Z. I assume in particular that on the level of the reduction mod P, I get the full group. Here P is assumed to be given and sufficiently large. Then what I want to show is that you have a uniform expander family when you vary n. So the ingredients, the start is always the same. So there is a first step, which is roughly reducing the problem to the non-existence of certain approximative subgroups. So there are two pieces there. First, there is what you may call an L2 flattening lemma. So from the non-existence of approximative subgroups, basically, what you can show using these non-commutative Balogh Semeridi goals is that if you do enough convolutions, now be aware that we already do a logarithmic number of convolutions to generate a big set, and then the number of extra convolutions is going to be in fact bounded, and that is absolutely essential if you have large Gerd. If you start from elements of SLDZ, is that you have right away by convolving, say, a small multiple of the log of q times, you get right away a very big set to amplify from. So in any case, there is this non-commutative Balogh Semeridi which will give you a measure, a convolution which is almost flat, and then you want to have to conclude from that you actually have a spectral gap. Now that comes with an argument going back to the work of Sarnak and Shu, which is the spectral multiplicity, which tells you that if you wouldn't have a spectral gap, then actually the convolution measure would be very much non-flat, and I will make that precise. So at this moment, if you want to have a set theoretical statement, you have to prove that you don't have this approximative group that carries a large weight of your convolution. So in our case, this is going to be captured using two ingredients. One ingredient, well, in fact, three ingredients. One ingredient is the Solovecki-type mechanism, which only works for that kind of modulus. Now, for the Solovecki-type technique to work, you have to start on some scale with a structure which is, you need to have, well, I would call it a well-structured set. Of course, you don't have a well-structured set necessarily. Now, to get that well-structured set, what is going to be used are two things. It's the theory of random matrix products and, of course, some product theory in Z mod QZ. The nice thing is that for that particular setting, well, nice to me at least, is that the group structure will not enter too much. Basically, the group through the Zariski density is going to enter now on the level of irreducibility of certain representations. It's not going to enter anymore by a very specific analysis like we heard yesterday. This is going to be considerably easier. Still, there are significant differences and difficulties on the same product level, because if you take some product theory mod, say, 3 to the n, this has absolutely nothing to do with some product theory mod p, for one reason. Now, why is this interesting? Well, I'll give you two reasons. The first is that since this method, which I will describe here for this particular modulus, is extremely robust, one basically can apply it without really understanding too much of the combinatorics of the underlying group, as I said. What is not unreasonable is that one can address a question which was proposed by Lubotsky and some of his co-authors, is the following. If I have a finitely generated group, which generates, say, something which is semi-simple, then what you like to produce is a family of it's a nested co-final family of normal subgroups, which has property tau. Now, if you want to get it nested, then the obvious things to look for are moduli p to the n. And moreover, they have the advantages of the techniques so you fix p, you let n vary, with p to the n are extremely adaptable to other situations. Now, the other application is the following. Assume that, so we have the product theorem in SL3p. Now, p is a very large prime. Assume we want to prove the expander. So we go through these steps. This is exactly the same thing. And we are reduced to the problem of proving that you don't have certain approximative groups. Now, Harald told us yesterday, the thing to verify is that there are no approximative groups that carry a large fraction of the convolution power. So, assume that your approximative group is sitting in a proper subgroup of SL3P, then, what you do is that you arc that this proper subgroup, for instance, through the work of Pink, the elements there will satisfy a non-trivial algebraic equation mod P. But on the other hand, we also know that, so what we are reduced to is proving that if you have a proper subgroup of SL3P, then the new L is not going to put too much mass on that proper subgroup. Here we are talking about an escaping lemma, but it's slightly different from the meaning it had yesterday, because no, escaping lemma really means that the probability, the new L of this proper subgroup should be exponentially small in L. Well, because somehow everything comes from a random walk with given generators, you can easily play with heights and verify that if such an equation should be satisfied mod p, then actually the equation is you can satisfy an equation without the mod p. So in order to conclude, what you use is the following statement. So that statement is a consequence of the result for the special moduli. Now it has nothing to do with moduli anymore. It tells you that if you have a set S in SLDZ which generates the risky dense group, you're taking the corresponding random walk, call it nu. Then if I take the iteration, the convolution powers nu L on of a non-trivial algebraic variety, I'm going to have a decay which is exponential in L. So in particular, well, I mean, this is going to be used. No, you have to be careful. The way this decay, this exponent depends, I say it depends on S, this is certainly true, also depends on the variety, but it only enters through the degree of the variety. So you can use that just to close the thing and to say that in fact, if you take the reduction of nu mod p, the nu L of a proper group is going to be exponentially small in L, and therefore you can conclude that you have an expander. Note that even in the case of SL2P, to conclude the expander from the product here, and there was another little piece of mathematics needed there, which is basically understanding first what are these other possibilities. Say if you have a group which is not all of SL2P, then there is the statement about trivial bicommutators, and then somehow you have to see, you have to say something about bicommutators on the free group, and at that stage we were invoking some results of Kesten on random walks on the free group. Here, of course, the situation is more complicated, but it is captured by that result. Now, I'm making you two statements here. The first statement, which is an exercise basically, is that this result can be derived without too much trouble from any spectral gap information, from any result about spectral gaps, mod whatever sequence of modules you want. So in order to get that in SL2Z, it's enough to have your spectral gap after reduction mod 3 to the n or something like that. The other statement is that I don't know of any proof of that without going to whatever, some kind of expander mod some modules. It may very well be. And in fact, I would almost expect it will be that there is a way to prove that directly without going to reductions mod Q. The trouble is that the literature I'm aware of, and I'm certainly not an expert, all the results about escaping are about escaping from linear varieties, not about general varieties. So if it goes like that, one first would have to reduce this problem to a problem about escape from linear varieties. And then there are the obvious difficulties that you like to have irreducibility and things like that, so that you can start applying the theory of random matrix products. Well, I will give you a quick sketch. So, if starting from the first step, what is important is to have what I will call the L2 flattening lemma. I described you already that. Basically, what you have to do is to show that by taking about a logarithmic of log Q convolutions, you can get nu L almost completely the uniform, almost the uniform measure. So if you would have an electronicity bound, which is one over the size of SLDQ, you would have the uniform measure. You don't quite have that. There is a distortion factor there, which is Q to the power gamma. You can get this gamma as small as you want, but at some point we stop. And we stop as soon as we can invoke spectral multiplicity. So this is what I call L2 flattening lemma. So all the problems are, the problem is reduced modulo the Sarnak-Chu argument to prove such an L2 flattening thing. And in order to get that, well, that's what I said, you're using the non-commutative Balogh-Semeradi Gowers, and that basically tells you that you can reduce the problem to the non-existence of approximative groups. So let me recall you what is an approximative group. Don't bother about the first part. Essentially what you have to disprove is that there is an H which is symmetric, which is approximatively stable under multiplication. So what you have is a small set X, so that H times H is contained in X times H and also in H times X. In particular implies that all the powers, all the products with a finite number of factors of H are in size not too much larger than H. H is not a whole group. Capital N was the size of G, so H is less than n at the power 1 minus gamma for a specified gamma. And one important property is that H carries a lot of mass, so mu is your L-fold convolution there, not exactly H, but some multiplicative translates of H, carries a lot of mass from your convolution power nu L. So you have to disprove the existence of an H which carries a lot of weight from the convolution. Now, when I say a lot of weight, it means something which is more than an exponential in minus L. So essentially, the statement which is here should be written as, let me write this down. So the nu is nu L x0h. That thing should be bigger than, is supposed to be bigger than exponential minus little o of 1. This is a small constant here, L. So that's, of course, a lot of information. So we have to prove that these things don't exist. Okay. Now, what I'm going to use, basically I'm going to bring in the Zariski density to total irreducibility of the of certain representations. The problem is that the theory in random matrix products is usually phrase, well, I mean, it is a theory about matrices over the complex numbers, and we need some modular reduction of some interpretation of these results, mod Q. Well, there are two results which are particularly useful here, which are completely classical. The first result tells you that if you have a random walk, typically the elements are going to have distinct eigenvalues with very high probability. The other lemma, and this is what I refer to the escaping lemma, but it's only for hyperplanes, it's the hyperplane escaping lemma. What it tells you is that if I fix a hyperplane, so I take a matrix eta, looking at the representation by conjugation, so I fix the xi and I look at xi g minus 1, so I get a representation in the traceless matrices. What I want to say is that it's not going to be stacked too long in a hyperplane. So the hyperplane is defined by requiring that the trace with multiplication with some other traceless matrix eta is equal to 0, and I require that I claim that the probability nu L of the G for which that the G xg minus 1 is going to be in that hyperplane is exponentially small in L. Now, this is not exactly what we need, because since we are working mod Q, we need to have an interpretation of these results mod Q, which is not very difficult. So the first statement is a statement about simplicity. And now, instead of having just simplicity, you need to have simplicity mod Q. So again, if I take the elements G in my orbit, and I require that the resultant of the characteristic polynomial of G and its derivative be non-zero, well, the complementary set, no, non-zero mod Q, the complementary set is going to be quite small, provided I take L sufficiently large compared with Q. And L has to be larger than the logarithm of Q. The other thing is the escape lemma, but now an escape mod Q. There I will look at the condition that the trace of G xg minus 1 eta be non-zero, but no, non-zero mod some number, say 0 non-zero mod Q1. And again, the claim is that you will have an exceptional set which is exponentially, which is small, like Q minus C, provided L is sufficiently large, the natural condition L bigger than logarithm of Q. Importantly, this estimate is uniform in xi and eta, provided you assume that the reductions mod Q of xi and eta be non-zero. Trace xi, trace eta are assumed to be equal to zero. So essentially, these are the same statements as the classical statements in random matrix theory, but with a reduction mod Q. Now, how do you pass from results in the complex numbers to results mod Q? Well, this is completely standard. What you use is a quantitative Bezout theorem. So the Bezout theorem, which is used here, is basically any Bezout theorem. If you don't have a quantitative Bezout theorem in the literature, any proof of the Bezout theorem is going to give you the results you want. So it's not a very sophisticated thing. You see, this is a statement about writing. So if you have a system of polynomials without common zero, you want to write a large, well, some not too large, as small as possible, integer delta as a combination of the polynomials p1, pn with coefficients which are polynomials q1, qn, and everything should have a height which is reasonably controlled. Now, there are three parameters there. There is a number of variables, there is a degree, and there is a height. Now, fortunately, the number of variables and the degree, they are under control, they are numerical, they are given. What is going up is the height. So what you want is that, in particular, the delta, which you have here, should be relatively small in the sense that the height should be proportional to the height of the inputs. Now, you can take any proof of the Bezout theorem, and you're going to see that this is true. If I would have to rely on the right dependencies in terms of the number of variables or the degrees, which is useful for some other applications, it would be in much worse shape than here. But here it's just a matter of controlling the height. So as you expect, if you have coefficients for the polynomials p which are of a certain size, well then the delta in particular and the q's are going to have coefficients which are some power bound by some power on the bound on the coefficients of the given polynomial. Remember, I started 5 minutes late. Yes, so keep that in mind. If I'm not mistaken. Okay, now the other ingredient is, we will not do too much anymore. What I want to do, of course, you use the construction of Helmholtz of large sets of commuting elements. These commuting elements you diagonalize. Unfortunately, to diagonalize, you need to take an extension field, and going from Z to the extension field represents certain challenges, and I thought it was going to be a complete routine to do this translation. This extension from Z to a number field, but this is not completely obvious. And for one thing, if you're looking at residue, set rings of residue classes, if you take residue rings for a general number field, you take the set rings of that, there is no good classification. There is no classification of the set rings. So there are a certain number of problems. But you don't have to go to an algebraic number field to make this thing, I would say, not trivial at all. So what I'm using here, say this is on the combinatorial side, and I would very much like to see a reasonable proof of that statement here. So we're having now my ring is going to be, instead of looking at the finite field, I'm taking a ring of the form Z mod QZ, where Q is a general integer. And my statements, this is very important, they should be uniform in Q. So the case where Q is just a product of a large number of distinct primes, this is what appears, for instance, in the paper with Alex and Peter Sarnak. But there is another case where you would take, say, Q 3 to the n or something like that. No, this has nothing to do anymore with doing some product in finite fields because it's, well, for one thing, it's full of zero divisors. And the kind of strategy that you have to use there is much, much closer to whatever I refer to as the discretized ring theorem, which is really the Archimedean counterpart of that. I mean, this is the Pleiadic counterpart. There is a completely different strategy there. So the theorem which is there is used in the special case for Q equals P to the N, but even for Q equals P to the N, this is not a complete triviality. So essentially what it tells you is that if you're taking a set A, which is not everything, and you like to say that either the sum set or the product set is going to be larger, the only possible obstruction is the obvious obstruction, namely that when you're taking the reduction Mod-Sum divisor Q1 of Q, this thing is going to be too small. So condition one tells you that your set is not everything. And condition two tells you that you have large factors for all divisors, and in fact you only need divisors which are sufficiently large. If you have that, then you can say that either the sum or the product set is going to be large. Note that if you go to a quotient of a number field, this is not true. And you need to make an extra assumption, namely that the ring generated by the reduction of A mod, say, assume that Q is a prime power, you have also to assume that so if I replace a prime by a prime ideal, there is an extra condition. If I take for Q, so I would take P at some power, so this would be replaced by Q, I still would need one condition, namely that the reduction mod P to the E of A generates everything. So generates O mod PE in a number field case, where is the ramification index of your prime ideal. Of course, this is not necessarily satisfied. And this is what creates quite a bit of trouble. Anyway, at the end of the day, the conclusion you will use is a statement about some product in a Cartesian product. And I will state it here in the context of the integers. The same statement remains valid in the context of a Cartesian product of a number field, of the integers of a number field. So this is basically the first step where you move to what you can call a structured set. So that statement is the following. I'm looking at a Cartesian product of the integers. In fact, that Cartesian product is just going to appear through the traceless matrices. I have a set A there. I don't have an assumption on A except that I assume that the reduction mod Q of A is going to be large, say larger than Q to the power delta. And then, well, I can do some product operations, and here I can do it because of the special structure of the modulus, which is a power over prime, and I can strongly rely on the Lie algebra. Well, what I can extract from some product is some quite modest object, but it's enough. I can extract basically a one-dimensional segment. So what happens is that you can find two scales, p to the power n1, p to the power n2. n1 minus n2 is about the size of n. And I find in an approximate some some product set A prime of A a segment, in the sense that I will get all the multiples of Q1 of Xi mod Q2. So in the Archimedean case, you can do the same if you do the discretized ring theorem over the complex numbers instead of over the real numbers. What is the meaning in the Archimedean language is that you would have in your sum product set, you would have locally in some neighborhood, so locally here refers to the N1, so essentially you would look this is Archimedean here, but the distance non-Archimedean language would be 1 over PN1, right? So inside a neighborhood of 0, what they will have is a segment here. Now, you don't have all the points in that segment, but what you can do is approximate every point in that segment up to a distance. So this thing here would be PN1. And then the approximation here would be 1 over p to the power n2, where n2 is considerably larger than n1. So this is what they call a structured set. Now, once you have this structured set, you use the full machinery of the representation, irreducible representation, to generate from that one-dimensional structure in your tangent space, basically, you want to generate the full tangent space. And this is just a matter of using irreducibility of certain representations. Once you generate your full, well, what you're going to generate then, instead of just a one-dimensional section, you're going to get a net of points in a ball, say, of radius 1 over PN1, which is dense up to 1 over PN2. And once you have that, you can apply the Solovey-Kitaev algorithm. So the Solovey-Kitaev algorithm tells you, essentially, once you have a well-distributed net in a neighborhood of the identity, then you can, by commutators, build up the whole thing at full scale. So you have to play this game at a relatively large scale, so the N1, the N2, etc., they should be small compared with N, and then you can build it up with commutators in order to get everything. And this is my last transparency. What is involved here are certain very simple things. The passage, say, from the group to the Lie algebra, these are also the identity that plays the key role in Solovey-Kitaev, which is the following thing. I take two elements, G and H. So this is formulated in the periodic language here, instead of looking at approximations for the Euclidean distance, I'm just taking the SUD context here and looking at the periodic context. So if you have two elements G and H, which are one respectively mod P to the M and mod PM prime, I'm so sorry, so you have to move this here. On one hand, I have the commutator GH, G minus 1, H minus 1, this object, which is going to be in a product set of my thing because it's on the level of the group. On the other hand, you can write it as 1 plus the commutator in the Lie algebra sense, GH minus HD. But what is important is that this holds up to a much finer scale. So before I had a scale which is P to the N, take M equals M prime. Here I'm going to have P at the power 3M. So this thing is used at two stages. It is used on the level of the initial construction of an approximate segment to get in the scale of some product theory. And it is, of course, used once I have this neighborhood here, as in the usual Solovey-Kitaev argument, to generate everything. Now, I want to just to finish by saying that there are two problems. This may be a little bit misleading if you look at the paper of Alex Jacobson and Peter Cernak about what are really the natural conjectures. And somehow, I don't really like this condition of Diophantine, non-commutative Diophantine property, because what is probably happening is something which is much easier. So let me state you two problems here. You see, basically you want to say something about generation, but beyond elements of SU2 which are algebraic, or beyond elements of SL2 ZP which comes from the integers. So what I really want to say is that if you start from any set, finite set in SU2, which is sufficiently dense in the topological sense, so dense up to a million or something like that, if you start looking at the L-fold product set, then you're going to be able to do an approximation which is exponential in L. The usual Solovey-Kitaev algorithm is going to give you exponential minus L at some power which is less than 1. If you have an expander, then you can get linear L. And so this is a question which is quite different from the non-commutative Diophantine property. And somehow answering this question, I believe, is the key to getting beyond special sets of generators. The same if you're working mod P to the N. Well, instead of having generators in the integers, you would take generators in the periodic integers. Then the problem is, again, the following. If we have a subset S in SL2Z, no assumptions, we don't want anything to depend on S, say. We have a reduction mod P, which is all of SL2P. This is the analog of saying that the thing is sufficiently dense. What we like to do is generate the whole group mod P to the N in a number of products, with a number of products L, which is linear in N. And making progress on that seems to be essential to remove dependences on generators, and probably with the techniques which are already available would probably answer this, get results which are generator independent. So I'll stop here. I think I'm all at the time.